Some look through this prism, seeking to find infinity, or perhaps an asteroid. The United States has for the first time in 4 years selected a new astronaut class. 8 have been chosen, 4 men and 4 women. To look at this class and the missions they might encounter, we're joined by Larry Young. He's the Apollo Program Professor of Astronautics at MIT. Welcome, Dr. Young.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, space still excites many of our imaginations. Take us inside their world. What kind of missions, what kind of duties should these astronauts expect?
Well, the astronauts that are being selected now, that are members of the new class of 2013, are going to have a very different sort of experience than those who were either in the early Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo program, where they were truly adventurers, or in the space shuttle program, where they were scientists and engineers going about a day's work. These people are going to be in a transition period as we go from the International Space Station onto some of the advanced vehicles, which will be used to take us into translunar orbit, Lagrangian points, eventually, we hope, on to explore Mars, so that they have a mixed career ahead of them. The lucky ones are going to be exposed to some fantastic adventures.
Now, you mentioned that they have a different set of skills, and they're not necessarily the astronauts that many of us grew up with, you know, the Buzz Aldrins and the Neil Armstrongs, who were naval test pilots and such. What type of skill sets, what type of training or expertise do these men and women need?
Well, among the current astronauts, we have PhDs, we have biologists, we have medical doctors, but overall, if you look at their backgrounds, it's surprisingly similar to the earliest of the astronauts in the Apollo era and their follow-on in shuttle. These people, to a great extent, have flying backgrounds. Many of them are either former military pilots or current military test pilots. These are people who have shown their skill in application of their talents in dangerous fields, as well as the intellectual pursuits that go along with them. Yeah, they're not the white scarf flyboys that we think of from the Right Stuff, but they're also people who are used to dealing with difficult, time-critical situations and retaining their cool.
So am I getting the sense that the Right Stuff to a degree still matters, that you have to meet certain physical parameters as well as intellectual parameters in order to make the cut?
I don't think so. And I'm not privy to the inside of the selection process, but when I went through astronaut selection, the physical was limited to passing of the medical examination. You did not have to be a super athlete or an Olympic gymnast to get through any of the tasks that were required. What they're mostly concerned with were astronauts who would retain their health and ability to function for a long period of time. So I don't think that the physical strength or agility is a factor, except insofar as it's come up in some of these side tasks and hobbies. You see scuba divers and skiers and so on among the candidates.
Now, you mentioned health, and one thing that I've read is that astronauts often face dangers from atrophy, lack of muscle use, because of a weightless condition. How significant is that problem? Or for a prolonged mission, especially one going to an asteroid or maybe even to Mars, what kind of risks might they encounter due to prolonged radiation exposure?
Well, Andrew, you put your finger on the toughest problem that we have in going to Mars, even tougher than getting the funding for it. But that's protection of the human on the long duration. By long duration, we're talking about a trip of perhaps 8 or 9 months to Mars, ride it for a year, spend another year coming back. There are significant dangers that have been identified and are still being studied but are by no means solved. And they are bone loss, muscle loss, cardiovascular deconditioning, changes in the balance system, and then, as you mentioned, the radiation risk during the interplanetary travel as well as the time on the surface of Mars. Those are all very significant risks. They raise the likelihood, for example, of cancer for an astronaut who was on a long-duration mission, and there are underway at this time consideration both of the standards, the ethical considerations of sending people on these dangerous missions, as well as alternate ways to protect them from radiation and protect them from the debilitating effects of weightlessness.
beyond the specific NASA class of astronauts, are there any works that you're involved in or collaborations which you're excited about?
Andrew, I'm very excited at this time on the work that we at MIT are doing together with the Skolkovo Institute of Technology, the new international university that is being constructed on the outskirts of Moscow. This is truly an attempt to try to, in a sense, recreate the excitement of the MIT community, the Stanford community, Silicon Valley, within Russia. And in particular, I'm happy to be able to work with my very talented colleagues at the Moscow Aviation Institute and at the Russian Academy of Sciences on trying to advance space technology toward the next generation of exploration, which will undoubtedly lead us to Mars.
Can you give us a little insight? What is one of the questions that you are working with your partners in Russia?
Well, one of the questions which we will be exploring with our partners at the Institute for Biomedical Sciences, Institute of Biomedical Problems, as well as the Nuclear Institute at Dubna, is the issue of radiation protection, and in particular, protection of the central nervous system against the sudden high-energy bursts of radiation that we get from galactic radiation, which is present all the time in space, as well as from solar radiation. There are capabilities and experience that have been accumulated in Russia, which very nicely complement the sort of work that my colleagues at Massachusetts General Hospital and at Brookhaven Laboratories are doing. That holds out real process advances and real promise for us. So that's one. My colleagues at the Moscow Aviation Institute share my interest in man-machine systems and advanced ways of transmitting information in the cockpit, whether it's the cockpit of a spacecraft or the cockpit of an aircraft, to the pilot to make for more effective, once again, human-robot interaction. So this is a nice opportunity to build on the strengths of both our folks at MIT and those that are our partners in Skolkovo.
And it also takes us full circle in terms of the questions and problems we were looking at in space flights in the future, whether to asteroids or to Mars, and the need for scientists, or the reality that scientists often don't deal with some of the same borders and the same politics that sometimes nations get hampered by.
No, I've been very fortunate to have worked with colleagues from the Soviet Union and from the Russian Federation on problems that are currently active, that are of interest to us both, in an open and trusting manner. This has been through the tough periods of the Cold War and through the better periods of the current time, and hopefully as this Skolkovo Technology Institute gets going, we'll see even more and more of those capabilities.
Now, in the PRISM, I've spoken recently with some scientists who are developing exo-armors for our listeners, think Iron Man, that astronauts might be expected to wear, or that people with paraplegia or quadriplegia might be able to wear. And the advantage of this apparatus was twofold. One was that it would give some assistance in trying to lift or get at materials, but it was also designed to give resistance. So if you were in the suit, it would allow you to exercise. Are tools like this necessary? Were you ever using devices like this to try to work out in either a simulated or actual space environment?
Well, there are really two separate things going on here. One is the use of robots in conjunction with humans for doing difficult, repetitive or time-consuming work. And clearly that's a field that's advancing very rapidly. But the use of devices to augment your own strength and abilities in extended weightlessness is of very great interest. My colleague at MIT, Professor David Newman, has been working on a biosuit in which there would be G-loading, which would force you to go and exercise against the extensions of your limbs. Or my Russian colleagues in Moscow at the Institute of Biomedical Problems, Dr. Kozlovskaya and her colleagues similarly have been for some years working on what they call their penguin suit, in which, just as you described, there is work required every time the ankle is extended, every time the elbow is flexed or extended. And this is all in an attempt to overcome this really rather serious debilitation that goes that we see affecting muscles and bone. So that's work in progress. On the International Space Station, we certainly use what's called the Advanced Resistive Exercise Device to force astronauts to be able to try to substitute for the missing gravity cues by working out against essentially an exercise machine, rather an advanced version of what one might see in the village gymnasium.
Now, you mentioned robots, so I have to ask, the idea of Mars has been exciting us even before Ray Bradbury was writing about it in science fiction novels in the 1950s. But why would we send a human to Mars versus another rover or a more sophisticated robot? What is the advantage of sending humans?
An excellent question. The issue always comes up of why take the risk and the expense of sending humans when robots could do the job? And the answer, quite simply, is robots cannot do the job, not at the current level of development. So really the right question is not humans versus or robots. The question is, how do we use humans in conjunction with robots to work symbiotically, to have robots do the repetitive, the dangerous jobs, to have humans do the jobs that require the kinds of exploratory capabilities we have, of looking at a rock or a rivulet or looking at a particular scene and coming up with the hypotheses and testing it, the kinds of work that we do as scientists. And we are, as my friends in artificial intelligence will agree, we're a long way from being able to produce with robots the kinds of effective scientific inquiry that we can do with humans. So the question that as I see it is, how do we fit humans and robots together in a program of Mars exploration to do it efficiently and safely? Yes, you're quite right. Long before Ray Bradbury, people were dreaming about going to Mars, and I hope that that's going to turn into a reality within all of our lifetimes.
Now, you mentioned artificial intelligence, but I have to wonder, is the problem really the intelligence of the robots or the rovers? Or is it simply the lag time of sending a command from Earth or from a space station thousands, tens of thousands of miles, hundreds of thousands of miles?
The lag time is significant, Andrew, and for your listeners who've not been up on this, to get a signal from Earth to Mars and back is limited, of course, by the speed of light, and the time lag will depend upon where Earth and Mars are in their relative orbits around the Sun, but it can be as long as 20 minutes. What this means is that you really want to have the robot be as autonomous as possible. You don't want to go and steer it the way you might steer a remote control toy by saying turn left, turn right, to speed up, slow down. You would rather send it a concise command in natural language, if possible, something of the order that says, climb that hill, look around, and let me see what is the appropriate way to descend into the next valley. So that's the issue is one of, yes, in a broad sense, the intelligence or the artificial intelligence in the robot, but a way of matching the robot capability, the learning capabilities of the robots, the data processing, the multisensory blending, to allow the robot to try to emulate some but not all of the exploration capabilities of a scientist.
And you just brought up an issue which I discussed last week on the Prism, which is computers and linguistics. The English language is a very difficult one. It's loaded with homonyms. It's loaded with single words that have 20 different viable definitions. So if we're trying to use naturalistic language, that's going to add another level of complexity for this robot, for this machine, to interpret exactly what you mean. I would imagine that the command codes or the commands that are issued must be on a tightly controlled script if we're using things like that, right?
Well, sure, language is difficult. English is a particularly difficult language. But who would have thought 20 or 30 years ago that we would, with some frustration, be able to call and make our airline reservations or to complain to the telephone company about our wireless service and do it all through a machine? It's really quite remarkable that the voice recognition systems have gotten to the level that they're at now and will continue to improve. So I think that we have to take our hats off to the advances that have already been made in human-robot interactions and looking at the robot as a partner in a joint activity rather than as some remote machine that you set about a fixed, inflexible task and it proceeds to either do it or stop.
And what you just brought up is actually one of my favorite sort of themes or discoveries about life, which is today, all of us are living in the land of science fiction. Think of that cell phone in your pocket. It's better than Captain Kirk's communicator. And I was thinking about the show Knight Rider the other day and why the reboot didn't work. And I think the reason the reboot didn't work is because, you know, in the 1980s, having a car with automatic doors and automatic windows and a GPS and several, you know, able to make phone calls, that was fantastic. Today, it's ordinary.
I'm about to speak to my high school reunion here in New York City, and in a sense, I'm jealous of these 17-year-olds who are going to have all of this technology of the future ahead of them, and some of them may have been jealous of me and my generation for having gone through the excitement of Apollo and beyond, but the technology capabilities that we have now are just amazing. You know, Arthur Clarke had many brilliant truisms, but one that's quoted often, it has to do with the question of whether a technological breakthrough is going to happen or will happen. And he said something to the effect that if you had ask an expert and says that it will, that this will take place, it probably will. But if you ask an expert who says, no, it can't take place, it probably will work anyway.
Well, learning that we have taken far more than one giant step for mankind. I'm Andrew Hiller for The Prism on The Voice of Russia. And I've been speaking with Dr. Lawrence Young. He's the Apollo Program Professor of Astronautics at MIT. It's been a pleasure, sir.
Keep your eyes on the stars.